this point, I would like to introduce you guys to Ira. Ira, hello.
Hi, how are you?
Hi. Just introduce yourself and what it is that you do.
Okay. My name is Ira. I am an MD PhD candidate at Wayne State University School of Medicine. My research has ranged from gynecological oncology to reproductive health disparities among Black women, as well as the impact of education in the incarcerated population. Currently, I attend Columbia University Mailman School of Public Health, obtaining my degree in public health.
Okay.
And yeah, that's about it.
Yeah, we know the credentials run long, big old resume. Well, thank you first and foremost for agreeing to do this. So I have you here because I want to speak. I've been speaking to these nurses, and the overwhelming thing that keeps sticking out both in the news and the media, even in my conversations, even with my friend Siobhan, who contracted COVID, like the overwhelming consensus is that the nurses do not feel adequately protected or don't feel like they have the adequate protection in regards mm-hmm. to PPE and procedure when it comes to dealing with the COVID outbreak in when it comes to the hospital. So what can you, as someone who is well-versed in, working in the public health space, what can you speak to in regards to that? Like, why is it that the hospitals are having them reuse PPE such as face masks and things of that nature? Like, why is it at this point during this pandemic that it seems that these hospitals don't have the nurses' best interest at heart?
It's not that they don't have the nurses' best interest at heart. I think it's very important to kind of step back and understand both sides of the issue before we pass on judgment, because none of us really know what it takes to run a hospital.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing that we need to keep in mind, that what contributed mostly to this is the lack of preparedness. And especially, there was no, efficient and effective evaluation program, about, for example, like if a pandemic occurs, if we have like an outbreak, what are we lacking for? There was one, actually, it was a simulation held by the federal government, that covered a pandemic that kind of looked like a lot like the one that we're facing now. It was basically like a respiratory virus that, you know, started in China and that it made its way to the United States and the rest of the world. And among the many problems, during like the evaluation, during the simulation as well, were like the deficiencies in personal protective equipment use, PPE. So that exercise, that simulation found that the U.S. did not have the means to quickly produce more PPE. And that's what right now, for example, we have like the federal government, states, cities, just kind of, you know, galvanize, use this time to seek out, PPEs, like the production of PPE. But I think one thing that the simulation, for example, highlighted was one, the deficiency of the equipment used. And there was just this big confusion and like bureaucratic chaos. As requested submission to multiple agencies all at once. So the basic, so to say, like understanding is that we were just not prepared. And you can't just blame it at the hospitals. We have to blame it at the system, you know, blame the system as a whole, because this thing was not taken seriously. So when this evaluation, this simulation, took place, you know, this was around the 2014-2015 Ebola outbreak, and President Obama administration actually took this seriously, and they produced a 69-page playbook in case of an outbreak. However, with the Trump administration, they neglected and rolled out back east efforts, which eventually disbanded this whole White House office that was specifically made for pandemics during the Obama administration. So now we've seen the results. You know, what we're seeing is just, you know, this lack of PPE, which is really unfortunate because it puts a lot of our doctors and nurses and all other medical healthcare professionals who are, you know, on the front lines, so to say, at risk, and at risk also infecting their own families as well when they go back home. So.
Okay. So I can't, like when you said that, I couldn't stop thinking about it. How does a country such as the United States, how do they not have adequate amount of PPE, even in, you know, just the type of superpower we are? Like, why do we not have this? Like, why is our government, why is the healthcare not being taking, why is that initiative, like, where's the initiative in that? Like, why is that happening?
Well, I mean, something like a pandemic, when it comes to pandemics and wars, I tend to think of them as like two things that have existed since the inception of time. Like they have occurred in the past, yet somehow they always come in and take us by surprise, and we're always so unprepared for them, you know, even though we know that they have the potential of happening. I know that earlier in March, the U.S. had around 12 million N95 respirators and 30 million surgical masks in their strategic national stockpile. And that was only, so according to like the officials, that was only about 1% of what the country needed in the full-blown pandemic. We live in, I don't know, this is also like human nature, right? When something like this happens, or like any, think about like any kind of tragedy, right, that happens, we always tend to think like, oh, you know, that's unfortunate, but that's probably not going to happen to us. And I think we've always kind of viewed these kind of, you know, tragedies, so to say, for lack of better wording, right? Like we've, even this pandemic was very, it very much ignored and not thought of as a big deal. It was, you know, there's mass media, for example, that, you know, started saying that the pandemic was just, the coronavirus was just a flu, you know, it'll go away just like MERS and SARS. And so when you don't take things seriously, you're not going to prepare for it. So of course you're just stocking hospitals with whatever is needed and not creating any kind of playbook, so to say, that focuses on what happens in worst case scenario. Like how many of us, for example, have built, for example, like a survival dungeon, right? Like we don't think of it because we're like, well, yeah, sure. Like there will be an end to everything, but not now. But how do you know that? So in a way, that's how, like, that's the kind of ideology that, you know, is, you see these kind of things because this, we never thought that this will turn out the way that it has turned out. And in fact, this all could have been prevented if we had taken those measures more seriously. With that simulation, we knew, like I said, that there was only like 1% of N95 respirators and 30 million surgical masks. So that was only 1% of what we needed in a full-blown pandemic like the one that we are experiencing now. And we did not take that seriously. So, and that has multiple people are responsible for that. It's not just hospitals. It's all like the whole system in general. And even, you know, we're talking about the federal government too, because they supply a lot of the funding as well.
So what is the, because I understand that, but you know, just as someone on the ground, just a regular citizen, we just see these, nurses, we see these doctors, we see these healthcare, these essential workers, almost like superheroes at this point, because every day they're going right into the thick of it and having to put their lives on the line. So I get how that happens, or I get, you know, the misfortune at the top or the misstep at the top, but how do we then, how do we now cure that and make things safe for these health workers?
That's something that requires a collective effort, because I don't think just, you know, having like one idea, everybody has to be on board. Otherwise, we're never going to see change. And unfortunately, the way that I think of it, and I think it's something that we always must pay like attention to, is the history, because the past and the present are linked to each other. So when you touch one end of that link, that links of the chain that links the past and the present, the other end always quivers. So not just that, but also think about just the implications of, or not the implications, more the power of ideology and its implications. Our ideology in this country, maybe in the entire world, but I want to speak to this country because I live here and I was raised here, is very individualistic and it's very ego-driven. It's kind of like every man for itself.
Mm-hmm.
It's very capitalistic. And the main objective in a capitalist society like the one that we live in today is to make profit. And so when your main objective is that, you don't care about the well-being of other people. You don't care about putting in a collective effort that you are, or having that ideology where you are responsible for every other human being in this world. Because at the end of the day, really what is needed in order to change this whole thing that we're caught in is to indulge in this new kind of consciousness, right? As a collective, as a whole society, that includes us viewing our society as an ecological system where my actions are responsible, I'm responsible for the implications that my actions have towards another human being.
Mm-hmm.
So I can't, the only way that I can explain, for example, why Jeff Bezos does not give masks and protective equipment to the essential workers, I can't answer that, because I know that the only thing that I can say is that it makes sense because Jeff Bezos is a capitalist. He lives in this capitalist country. That's not his objective. I can't change his new consciousness. That's a responsibility that lies in our shoulders. And I hope that during this time, right, where this COVID-19 is exposing a lot of layers to the sophistication and the pestilence of, you know, not just capitalism, of racism, of every other social issue that is exposing these inequities within every system, right? And I hope that we take this time to kind of reflect and hopefully build on that new consciousness that is needed to create a better, a more just, a healthier, and a even more equitable society. But that's going to take, one, a very long time,
right,
and two, it just needs a lot of people on board, you know?
Who needs to be on board?
People at the top. They're the ones that are making the rules. You and I can talk about it, and hopefully, I don't know, you know, we're still young, and you never know, like, in the future, where life will take us, what endeavors we might pursue, so to say. But right now, our people who are in positions of power have to at least have the consciousness to listen and do a better job, actually, of listening to what the people are saying. And there's a huge disconnect in that. And I think it's also important because it's easy to say, like, why can't legislators, you know, listen to us when we're saying XYZ is wrong? At the end of the day, there are so many layers to this system of power that, you know, sometimes it's even hard for us to comprehend. Like, for example, and this is a little bit digressive, but just to kind of give you an example of how sophisticated it is that a lot of people here in New York are saying, like, well, freeze the rent. Like, have you know, we can't pay rent or anything like that. Please, the mortgages. And that's not possible. And I say that because, like, not just with the housing crisis in New York, but the mortgage system, that's so many other systems in this country. It is so intricate because when you freeze rent, the investors do not get paid. And you and I might say, like, well, I don't care if investors don't get paid. But if they don't get paid, that check that comes in our grandma's mailbox every month, that check will be cut off. So it impacts, like, the Social Security check that the elderly receive, that they live on that check. So it's very complicated. You shut up one thing and there's another. So this whole thing is just to be destroyed and rebuilt from the scratch. I don't like when people say, like, oh, the system is broken. The system is not broken. It is sophisticated. It is intricate. It is built the way that it's built, and it was supposed to leave people out. Even the healthcare system, it was built on the objective of profit making. It wasn't built on, you know, the goodness of the heart and maintaining the well-being of other people. Absolutely not. Actually, Blue Cross Blue Shield as a healthcare coverage, which started in the 1960s or so, it started because, in 1940s or so, it started because of at Baylor University, because there was the Great Depression, and they needed to figure out a way how to keep hospitals not going bankrupt, which is another thing. And this links, you know, back to the conversation with administrators and hospitals right now. The fact that they're lacking so many, like, resources, and they need a lot of people, you know, with all hands on deck, so to say. And there are, it's over capacity as well with patients. You think, like, who's paying for these things? Right? Like, what I am scared of the most is the aftermath and the legacy that COVID-19 will leave. Because I can't help but, like, think, not just on how many nurses and doctors will be cut off and laid off, how many hospitals will cut off other programs and whatnot in order to make up for what they're losing, because they're losing money. That's money going down, being flushed in the toilet. And that, you know, that's not something that we should think right now, because our main priority is saving people's lives. Right. That should be, that is the main priority. However, you have to think, for example, like what happens after things start to, quote unquote, normalize, whatever that will look like. How many hospitals will go bankrupt? And it really is something to consider also, that the hospitals that will suffer the most are hospitals that are located in areas that are, like, in Brooklyn or the Bronx, where majority of the population are, like, communities of colors, of color, right. Black and Hispanic. And that's unfortunate, because there, if you look at, you know, their data, for example, you see, you know, it's just alarming, the death toll of Black and Latino without the pandemic. So, I mean, we're talking about, like, the inequities, you know, without the pandemic, let alone what this pandemic is doing, that's exacerbated, so to say.
So, let me go back to your time in the hospital. What was your extent or experience in the hospitals? Obviously, it was before COVID, so you know, I'm trying to paint a picture of what it was like leading up to it. So, what was your experience in the hospital?
So, I did 5 years at Detroit Medical Center while I lived in Detroit, and Detroit Medical Center is located in the very heart of Detroit. Detroit is the blackest city in the United States, so majority of our patients were Black Americans. And, you know, the health disparities are real. The thing with Detroit Medical Centers at the time, also when I worked, it was also during the time of recession. And that greatly, like, it really impacted us. And the thing is, like, the resources were scarce, the waiting time for patients was unimaginable. And I did have like a rotation, for example, in a suburb, for a few months at another hospital. And the differences were astonishing, starting from the waiting time of patients, to the demographics, of course. And also the resources. And by resources, I mean not just the tools, the equipment, I also mean the staff,
right.
How many staff were supervising medical students and residents. While at the DMC, Detroit Medical Center, you were just kind of left there to improvise with whatever you had, which, you know, is just alarming when you think about it. However, like I learned a great deal while I was there. You know, especially that's what got me so interested in, you know, delving more into issues of inequity and the health disparities among, specifically for my research, so to say, was reproductive health disparities among Black women in Detroit. But basically that was, I didn't spend like too much, because I did a lot of like clinical trials and whatnot. So for me, it was more like research heavy. Dealing with directors and how funding is allocated and what studies, they're prioritizing and whatnot. And at the end of the day, it really is all politics. Because at this core, like I said, these systems were built for one thing, and that is profit. And of course, every year we do see improvements, right? As more people are raising their voices. And I think one of the main contributors, actually, to kind of seeing anything that revolves around health inequity is by increasing the number of Black doctors.
Mm.
And I think that's very, very important. That's like one thing that should be, you know, just completely not underestimated at all. In medical schools, in teaching hospitals, to have Black staff, especially if you are a hospital that serves, you know, a good portion of, you know, the Black population or, you know, Latin population, have the diversity of that, because they bring out this issue, you know, these really valid concerns, because people tend to not even think about the social determinants of health. How many articles, for example, this past week have published, you know, the death toll of Black Americans in the context of COVID-19. We saw like numerous of them, right? But not a lot of them really went into like what I like to call the meat and potatoes, right? Like the root of the whole problem, right?
Because which would essentially be what?
It would be the legacy of, well, the pestilence of racism. That's what I like to call it. The legacy, for example, of the many racist policies, starting from housing segregation, like redlining, to the pollution, the poisonous air, to water injustice, right? Like Flint still does not have clean water. There were water shutoffs, for example, in Detroit, and they have, because, you know, people living in poverty, they could not pay their bills. And so it took the governor, you know, many, many years, like this pandemic to occur, for them to, halt the water shutoff so people could have water in order for them to adhere to WHO's guidelines. But this is temporary. This is not sustainable. And this is like the thing, if we do not admit the many layers of how corrupt, morally corrupt this system is, then we will never make sustainable solutions. We will always put band-aids on wounds that are so deep.
Mm.
So, that's why I think, like, I always think one of my favorite quotes is the future belongs to those who prepare for it today, by Malcolm X.
Mm.
And I think that a lot of people need to reflect on that, because the kind of preparedness that he's asking, or at least that's how I interpret it, is truly to kind of delve you know, go look inside and explore the very dark corners of your soul in order for you to have this new consciousness of what is needed in order for you to make change. But at the same time, you can't do it alone. It's impossible to do it alone.
Wow. What hopes can we, like, what type of hopes should or can we realistically have when it comes to the betterment and procedure and protection of our healthcare workers, whether they be nurses, doctors, dietary, whatever the case may be? What realistic hopes should we have in the near future for their safety?
I think with COVID-19, the reputation of doctors and of public health officials has taken a better term. There has always been this mistrust that is tied to the health system, but we always kind of put doctors in front thinking that they make all the decisions and everything like that. But I think seeing them on the front lines and truly practicing medicine the way that it ought to be practiced, right, with humanity at the center, it's really making us think, like, hopefully we're gaining more trust and we're listening more to them, public health officials and medical professionals, especially when it comes to, like, the guidelines and believing in science and whatnot. So I think that there is this really beautiful spotlight that is, you know, that is shining the light on that community. But I think, you know, they need to speak out, even speaking up and speaking out is a courageous act, right? That's what a lot of activists always do. People right. that we admire, like Martin Luther King, Malcolm X, they all spoke out. And there, you need to have courage in order to speak and show up. That's a risk that people are willing to, like, that they have to take. The best thing that we can do, the hope that I see, is this positivity and the fact that we can allow and, kind of highlight the narratives of medicine, the patient's stories, the doctors and the nurses speaking out. And I think that just kind of like the human face of this very tragic turn of events, right, that we're all experiencing, so to say, which hopefully the more stories, so people really, there are statistics, right? But the public really doesn't understand statistics and numbers as well. What touches the human soul is human narratives, is the story, right? So when we have doctors and nurses in the medical community and patients also who have survived this to speak on it, I think this will hopefully galvanize some type of policies, for example, that include a program evaluation, right, where we can draw out the lessons learned and figure out that, okay, if something like this were to happen again, what must be, you know, what are the main points that we must have, like, you know, funding, PPE, how many, like, staff should be on rotation, how many hours, like, these are all very, very important. And in every state needs to have this because every state is different. The way, like, the burden that New York has is not compared to the burden, for example, in Colorado. Because New York City alone, this whole island has, what, 8 million people? And that might be the population of an entire state somewhere in the Midwest. So I think, you know, each state, and given that each state is very different in values, so to say, and politics, you know, that they do say whatever, you're going to see a difference in how these, you know, policies and program evaluations will take place. But I think that's something, you know, my hope is just using this spotlight that is shed on public health and medicine to highlight the narratives of medicine that hopefully can create like some change in order for people to start taking things more seriously, start believing in science again, and start, you know, gaining that trust with medical professions that was missing.
Wow. Well, thank you. You definitely gave a lot of background to, you know, and definitely gave a I would like to think an inclusive perspective on both sides. Well, you know what? I didn't ask you this. Okay, what can, knowing all that, knowing where this stems from, knowing all that is, but still living in the right now, what can the healthcare workers do to protect themselves?
That's a difficult question. And that's something that is up in the air. Because that's also something that I cannot answer, given that I am not in the front lines, you know, during this whole pandemic. I think, you know, if as an outsider looking in, so to say, and kind of going back from the experience that I've had on how, you know, things work in hospitals, the best thing that you can do is just hope that you come out alive. Not be optimistic, but just be hopeful. I think that's the one thing that we need to come to terms with. Sometimes, you know, it's easier for us to accept it instead of having this optimism, right? Because I think of optimism as you hoping for the best in given, you know, the same kind of procedures that are occurring, the same kind of system, the same kind of approaches that are ineffective. So you, it's kind of like, you know, hopeless in a way. But if you, so optimism, yeah, in a way, optimism is hopelessness. Having, being hopeful, that is what I think is needed more. Hopeful in regards to things changing. Not things working out with what we have, but things completely changing and hoping that this, you know, will supply soon. But I don't know, right now I'm extremely thankful for not just healthcare workers, but basically like everyone that is considered to be on the front lines, the, you know, the post office, folks, people working at grocery stores, delivery guys and women. So, really everyone, just, I hope that we become more grateful to people that we often kind of disregard as unskilled, and people that a lot of the conversation was like, oh, they don't deserve, you know, a $15 minimum wage because they're not unskilled. Yeah, but they're caring. They are the backbone of this country. That is what is keeping that little economy that we have alive. And I just hope that, you know, I hope they come out alive and they come out healthy. That's all I can say.
Well, thank you once again. Just one more time, just say your name and what it is that you do.
Yeah, I'm Ira Maimai, and I am a researcher on gynecological oncology and health disparities among Black women in Detroit. And also, I am a public health student at Columbia University Mellon School of Public Health.
Thank you so much, Thank you so much for your time, Ira. Appreciate you greatly.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Speak to you soon.